Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 635. Kyle, do you have anything for the community pages?
I do.
Community pages.
I've got one in particular that I feel like could not be more relevant to Nerdist stuff. It was sent to us by Anne Tana Wardrum, and it's her friend Kevin, who runs a website called VintageBowling.net.
I am way on board.
And he is a photographer and a bowler who is super into photographing vintage bowling alleys around the country to both show the beauty of hand-built bowling alleys and then on top of that support people keeping vintage classic bowling alleys open.
I am going to tear up at that
that's
amazing.
You got to see the site. It's phenomenal.
I bought a vintage bowling scoring table.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it just reminds, like, you know, when I grew up, you know,
you had the
scoring table, you had to write it on the scoring table, and if you were bowling league, you had that basically like that kind of like cellophane thing with the grease pencil, and you always burned your arm writing on the thing because the light under the projection unit got so hot. And so it's stories like that that I'm like, oh, that's an old-timey thing that people now wouldn't understand.
Yeah, I had not seen non-mechanized bowling scoring until we did that show at the Roosevelt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then I was like, oh, my God, there's a guy. And
chalkboard
you have to, like,
scoring.
Write it down.
Yeah.
The guys used to have to set up the pins.
And the score is so hard to keep track of.
No.
I think so. I'm bad with math.
Bowling is very easy. It's just,
I tried it once. I failed miserably.
Your score is the number of pins you knock down in each frame.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get a spare, then it's 10 points plus your first ball on the next frame.
See, that's where I like.
No, so if you get a spare,
confused.
let's say your score is 12,
okay.
You get a spare in that frame.
Okay.
All right. And then,
my next frame plus 10.
Yeah. So, and then you knock down 6 pins, right? So 10 plus 6, 16. So then 18 would be your score under the spare. So
okay. All right.
And then a strike is 10 plus your next 2 balls.
Oh, Jesus.
And if you get a double, then it's 20 plus the first ball of your next, of the third frame.
Now I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
When you score turkey, which is of course 3 strikes in a row,
yeah.
In olden days, did a man come out and do an animated clip art version of a turkey dancing to celebrate your victory?
It was live action clip art.
Yeah. Oh, so, good. Oh, beautiful.
Which meant that it was a generic same version of that guy all over the country coming out.
I want live action clip art to become a thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
That was some of the early franchises in America.
Anything else in the community pages?
There's one more I want to throw out that just fascinates me.
Community cork. I'm going to call it the Nerdist Community Corkboard.
Oh, I love it. That's David Farr sent me a thing. He is from Chicago, and they are working on this project where it's, I guess there's a whole school of magic called Chicago Style Magic.
What?
Yeah. And he wrote this long essay that I don't have the time to read, but I sure shit read it yesterday on the events page. And it's fascinating how Chicago in like the 20th century shifted the way the approach to magic in like parlor and different magic pieces came. And he and a group of other magicians do a show at the Greenhouse Theater Center. That's a $20 show that goes through and is trying to push like this sort of regional style of magic that developed and give just a really amazing sense of like the historical context of magic in the area. The show is Wednesdays at 8. And it's the website is magic-cabaret.com. And if I lived in Chicago, I would be totally going to this. I am utterly fascinated by it.
Good. And then I just got this email from a guy named Jesse Edmond. Rochester's longest running improv comedy troupe, Nuts and Bolts, is celebrating 15 years of being at least moderately funny, he says in the email. February 21st at 8 p.m. at the Spotlight Theater, which is in the village of Fairport. So
do you think
go to NAB Comedy to check that out. I haven't seen it, but
do you think that as they get older, their nuts start to sag a little?
That's going to happen to all of us, Kyle. Sorry, you're young.
No, the men are going to stay tight. I'm putting Botox in them.
Oh,
you should see other Botox.
I'm sorry.
Imagine how bad that would hurt.
Oh, yeah.
You can't imagine how bad that would hurt.
No, like, I think it would.
But it would be real bad. It would be real, real bad. And, of course, tickets are available for my upcoming tour dates at funcomfortabletour.com in cities all around the country. This episode of the podcast is Jeff Bridges. Again, he came back a third time.
He loves us.
He's the best.
He is the best.
Person ever.
Can we call him Uncle Jeff?
What?
Can we call him Uncle Jeff?
Yes.
Yeah.
Jeff is promoting Seventh Son, which is in theaters now, which also his sleep tapes, Dreaming with Jeff.
Have you listened to that goddamn record yet?
It's amazing.
Album? It's the most amazing thing.
You want to power down for some cool sleep.
So cool. And then it just gets crazy by the end. And like, he's talking about, like, I like the sound the toilet bowl makes.
He's great. And we, you know, like, for the third time, I got really nervous. I'm like, I don't know what to talk about with Jeff. We talked to him twice. And I feel like, you know, he's so cool. And it, the conversation with that guy just flows because he's so cool and open. And he'll talk about anything. And we ended up meditating with him, which was, I wanted to be cynical about, but couldn't be because it was rad. And so, Jeff Bridges, you're welcome on the podcast every goddamn week if you want to. Nerds Podcast number 635. Jeff Bridges returns again. Jeff Bridges.
Aww.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Walking a second ago. No, it's all right. I broke it. It's totally broken. That was less than 5 minutes.
Yeah, and I got I had a whole elevator drama too that really stalled me. I could have done it in two.
What?
Oh yeah, but I got stuck in the elevator and down to the bottom floor. Anyway,
what if an hour later, like, where did Jeff go? And he just can't.
And then I realized once I got back, I said, "Wait, what floor?"
Trying to every floor, every room.
Oh god.
then you're going to door to door, almost like room service.
Exactly.
Hi, it's Jeff Bridges. What? I'm here at your door. So this is the book. This is the photo book from Seventh Son.
Yeah. Don't want to push that on you or anything.
No, not at all. Please.
And then the stipulation I'd like to make, if you use these things, to use it to show the photograph at some point, each photo in full frame.
Yeah.
They're with this wide lux camera I take.
Yeah.
You know, and then if you want to zoom in and pan on it or whatever, you can do that. But it just at some point show the whole thing.
Look at that picture of Kit Harington.
Let's see. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's a good picture. These are great. What a fun thing. Do you take roles based on, yeah, I think I could photograph the shit out of that process?
No. I don't know. What do I do? It's just I've been doing it. Yeah,
oh, cool, we're in. Cool. We're in.
No, I've been doing it since Starman.
Yeah.
Karen Allen.
Yeah.
Had this idea. She saw some of the photographs I was taking, and she said, why don't we put a little book together as a gift for the cast and crew? I said, oh, that's a cool idea. And so we did, and then I've been doing it about every movie since then. I make this book of shots from this wide lux camera I have. It's a panning still camera. So
okay.
The lens itself pans. I first got hip to it in high school when they were taking our class picture. Maybe you had this experience too. And there was a rumor going around that the guy had one of these cameras, a panning still camera. So the lens pans very slowly. And if you run real quick, you could be in the picture twice.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was true. You could do that.
Do you have to stand there for a minute to hold it?
Well, it's an interesting camera because it's quite quite forgiving in that you can handhold a shot at a 15th of a second.
Okay.
Which normally, if you took it with a normal photograph, it'd be kind of blurry. You know, it's hard to hold that still. But a 15th of a second with this panning thing takes about this long. So during that time, I can literally paint with that camera. I can... You know, wherever I hold it still, that's in focus and sharp, and the rest is kind of blurry, and you get interesting effects that way.
Do you have a dark room? Do you develop them yourself?
I used to when I was a kid, yeah. But this is a film camera. You know, nowadays they just stitch it, you know, with, digital.
Where do you take your camera? Oh, they stitch it.
But this is film.
This is film.
Like old school.
Do you go to like CVS and drop it off and write Jeff Bridges on the thing?
No.
Who develops their film?
I want to say Photo Impact. I'm thinking that's the name of the joint. I can't remember. I think that's it. Yeah.
Boy, the smartphones really blew the Fox Photos
man, they even stop making film, you know. Stop making, you know, what's the name of the cameras that they
use?
Panavision. Those cameras that, you know, used to make, you know, movies out, you know, with film. Stop making them cameras.
Do you ever, every once in a while, I like to go, I don't know why I like this. Maybe it's just, I'm morbid, but I like to look at the old Victorian death photos. Do you ever look at those, the Memento Mori photos, where they, it was right around the time when photographs became a thing and it was sort of a luxury and people would take pictures of folks who had died immediately, like right after they died, they would dress them up and take a picture because it was like, they were preserving them. In their minds, they were preserving them.
Oh, yeah.
And mortality rates were so high that they just – I think they had a slightly different relationship to death. And so they're the creepiest. But because of the photographic process, you had to sit for so long. Sometimes the living would hold the dead person up between them. And if the living people moved at all while they were waiting there, they were a little blurry. But the dead people are always crystal clear because they're just dead.
So the live people almost look more ghost-like.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah.
You know, do you know Witkin? You know the photographer Witkin?
No.
Oh, man. You've got some interesting stuff in store for you. Witkin, these are amazing photographs. He would do things like cut off two heads, corpses, and lock them in a kiss.
Oh.
And that would be, you know, in the huge, you know, huge pictures of that. Just do bizarre, macabre framings. That might be a good visual for you guys.
Put some Witkin pictures in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, here's a nice picture of Julianne Moore. Why are these dead people kissing?
Yeah. Oh no, it's quite remarkable.
Have you ever thought about going on just a photo sabbatical? Just like, I'm going to take a year and just go take pictures all over the place.
I never thought of that. Most of my pictures are all at, you know, when I'm working. You know,
yeah.
Because just what I seem to do. I'll have some pictures of the family. I got, you know, a series of those.
Yeah.
But mainly it's when I'm working.
What's the best – what has been the best environment for you? Like which film do you feel like this was the most fertile environment for photography and this gave me the –
Yeah. Well, that's probably one of the reasons I do it at work, because it's such just light-wise, it's such a dynamic place to photograph, because you've got these master photographers and guys who are lighting these scenes, and the ambient light coming off of those, you know, gives you wonderful lighting for my shots. And sometimes you know, just rip their shot off, you know, just get, you know, right, you know, like for instance, what was it in Fearless, you know, did, I'm trying to think, was it Davio, Alan Davio, I think, was he shoot that? I think, yeah, his lighting would be so, you know, remarkable. And the great thing about the Wilux, or one of the cool things about it, it's a bit how, I think it's more reflective of how the human eye sees, you know, how like when you're looking at me, we have peripheral vision.
Right.
So we kind of see stuff off at the side. The normal frame of a photograph says, look at this. You know, this is what you're supposed to look. But if you look at these, like here, hand me the picture. So here in this book, the cover of this Seventh Son, you've got this, right?
Right.
And then you've got this. You know what I mean?
It pulls out.
Another little story, you know, or something. There's stuff on the side, you know, where you've got – this is a shot of Julianne Moore.
That's an amazing picture.
And you've got her, you know, checking herself out in the mirror, doing mirror tricks. And then you've got Kit Harington and my daughter Jessie, who is my assistant on the movie, playing Past the Pigs over here.
Well, you're brave to let Kit Harington near your daughter.
Yeah. They got along quite well.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Are you sort of irritated by the digital? Oh, yeah.
See, if I had my camera, I'd take a picture of you like that. I have a whole series of tragedy and comedy masks, you know, like the actor's mask, but actors doing that. And that's all in one frame.
One day I'm going to convince you to go bowling with me, and then you can bring your camera and we'll take pictures.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's going to – one of these days. I feel this is your third time on the podcast. I feel like – soon the bowling invitation for reals is not going to be crazy.
All right, that sounds good.
Are you irritated by the sort of the digital photography revolution and the fact that, you know, you can use fake filters and fake framing to manipulate rather – like I could just take a picture of – point my phone out the window, not even look, and then later on go, oh, I'll just crop this way and put a filter on it. Oh, look, I'm a photographer.
Yeah, no, not irritated. I think it's, you know, pretty great that, you know – you know, that, what do you call it? You know, technology, you know, it's got some great things about that. But the Wide Lux, has some things that the digital camera can't really do yet. You know,
yeah.
The fact that it's this actual panning still lens and there's a lot of movement, like what you say with mm-hmm. the, you know, the blurred image, you know, and so you get with a Wide Lux. I don't know if you can do this digitally yet, but if I take a picture like of you and there's some movement back here, those guys will be blurred. You'll be sharp. You know, I'm not sure if the digital has that. Probably do. I don't know.
What's your favorite picture you've ever taken?
I don't have one of those.
Really?
No. I got some faves, you know. I got one of my faves is from Lebowski during the Dude's Dream,
uh-huh.
you know, the kind of the Busby Berkeley, you know, yeah. dance number with the girls with the bowling pin hats and stuff. And I thought, oh, this would be a good day to invite my family. This would be fun for them to watch. My girls were all, you know, quite young, you know, 6, 7 years old, something like that. And then they brought them on board. And then I realized, Jeff, what the hell are you thinking? This is the day where you will be pulled on a skateboard through the legs of all of these women looking up at their vaginas. You know, why did I invite all my girls and my daughters to see this? So here I am, and, you know, and I'm realizing this, and I'm trying to make light of it. Kind of, you know, I go up to the head. We call them bowling pin Corinnes, is what we referred to them as. And I went to the head Corinne, and I said, "Gee, this is a wonderful photo opportunity. Do you mind if I snap my shot with my camera? You know, my Wide Lux." And she looked at me, and she said, "By all means, dude." So I get on my skateboard, on my back, and I'm. Say, well, I got to look up, man. I look up, and there I see this leotard-covered, thank God, vagina. But out of the sides of the leotard are huge tufts of pubic hair. And I go, what? And I'm starting to be pulled, and I snap my camera. I go to the next girl, and those tufts are even more ornate and abundant. And the next one even more. And it just like, you know, and it goes on and on like that. And what they did is they went to the makeup man and got, you know, a bunch of crepe hair.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So they pulled one on the dude. And fortunately, my girls and my wife were in on the gag. So that was okay.
That's but, what a fan.
But I have a shot. That's one of my favorite shots. Perhaps you could show that.
Yes, we can pull that up, right? Absolutely, yeah. We'll put that up there too. Because a lot of these are on your website, right?
Some of them are on my website. You might check and see if that one is on my website. But what was I going to say? I spaced out what I was going to say.
That's all right, because your story reminded me of a story that I read on Reddit the other day about Tallulah Bankhead, the actress Tallulah Bankhead. She was shooting with, she's working with Hitchcock, and she notoriously apparently never wore underwear. And so there was a scene where she kept having to climb up a ladder, and the crew started complaining because she was not wearing underwear underneath, and everyone could see everything. And so they went to Hitchcock, and they're like, you gotta tell her to do something about that. And his comment was something along the lines of, I don't know if I should alert a wardrobe or the hairdresser.
Very good.
But I have always – I don't pretend that I really understand photography, but it's definitely – it's an art that I really, really wish that I mean, because it's so easy to fake, but then really understanding like how to go out and, you know, like composition and natural lighting, and I just don't – I don't see it.
It's a really a miraculous invention, isn't it, to capture – the lights and shadows of a particular moment, and then that you have that. I mean, that's such an amazing thing, man.
But it is. But it is also. It's so much how it mirrors. I think how our perspective in situations work, because we can both look at the same thing,
all right.
And we're both going to come away with completely different stories.
That's true too. That's like very lifelike, isn't it? Yeah, that's how we are. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to get the last time. You were on. We had an amazing talk about relationships.
Yeah.
And people who listened were so blown away and I think kind of enriched in a way, because you had a lot of good lessons for people and relationships. First of all, are you doing anything for Valentine's Day, or do you think that's a load of crap?
No, I've got plans. I'm usually pretty bad about it, but I've got some plans.
You do have some plans this year.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. These are I went to Twitter and asked people to throw some questions at you, because I feel like, you know, I dominated so much of the time the last time you were on. So these are just random people on Twitter. The hashtag was DudeQs. And here we go. This is Jacob Belcher wanted to know, walk us through a typical day from morning until night.
Well, I can give you a typical recent days.
Okay.
In promoting stuff, you know.
Okay.
Because that seems to be one of the aspects of my life is, being a salesman. It's kind of what I'm doing here now.
I guess in a way, yeah. When you go through the press part, you're saying.
Yeah, this is like the Barker of the carousel, you know, of the entertainment business. And it can be, kind of draining and it's tough. I mean, you've been to those things where they put you in a room, you know, and you got 60 to 70 5-minute interviews. You've done those, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes. And it's bizarre. And I'll often, with my publicist, Gene Severs, there's a kind of a game that a lot of folks play, which she will give me a word that I must insert in the interview somewhere. And the more absurd the word, the better, you know, like snorkel.
Right.
Asparagus. You know. And we'll have a contest, you know. And then she sometimes give me, you know, time within a certain time frame, you have to say that word. But finally, towards the end of the day, I'll just, at the beginning of the interview, I'll say, snorkel.
just get out of the way. Anyway.
But the days can be kind of fun, too. This last one, I got to do it with my buddy and fellow actor, Julianne Moore, who's in Seventh Son. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, dear friends, and she was Maude in Big Lebowski. We had a lot of stuff to kick, and we approached the work in a very similar way. And that was a lot of fun, just kind of riffing off each other and that kind of thing. But those days recently was just doing a series of those, you know, from, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning till, you know, 6 o'clock at night doing these things. And they're kind of acting exercises in a way, because it's, you know, they ask you the same questions, you know, and you gotta, you know, like when you're doing a different takes of different scenes, you know, make it fresh every time it's happening for the first time, all those kinds of things. So you try to have fun with it. So you do that, and then, you know, then just, you know, falling asleep, you know, getting ready for the next day. You know, so we had a few series of that. And then there's a lot of music involved. Jimmy Kimmel. I'm going to do Conan tonight, probably do some tunes on that.
Nice.
That's kind of fun. I got to do that with my group, The Abiders, and push our album, a live album that we put out this last summer called Live, Jeff Bridges and The Abiders. It's available on iTunes.
Check it out. Pick it up right now.
Yeah.
Don't stop this podcast to pick it up. Yeah. But as soon as this podcast is done, go pick it up.
Write it down. Yeah.
So that's pretty much a day. When you're doing press junkets and you have to keep everyone fresh, like every the same five questions fresh, do you find yourself like pausing in the same places each time, go, oh, thoughtful pause, even though you know exactly what the answer is?
Yeah, so,
what was it like to work with this director? Oh, interesting.
I have done that. It's called bad acting.
Well, you can get into these places where you're the front of your head is on autopilot and the back of your head is like, I got to pack later. Yeah. I got to travel tomorrow.
It's tough. You know,
like separating into two distinct directives. All right, this is a good one.
Have you ever been on the other side of that?
You mean being interviewed?
Yeah, interviewed.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Intensively, you know, where there's a bunch of them in a row like that.
Yeah, it's I've done junkets a bunch, and then for TV shows, and then the draining ones are like those morning radio tours where you call a number, and then that guy connects you every 10 minutes to a different radio station for like 3 hours straight.
Yeah.
And then you talk to like 30 morning radio shows.
Yeah, that's tough, man.
It is, because it's like being dropped into a circus every 10 minutes. You don't know what the fuck, like, people are just saying shit at you and you don't know what their dynamic is, and you're just trying to stay awake because it's 3 a.m. because you're on the West Coast. And
so bizarre, yeah.
Yeah, I know. And it is the same over and over again. Yeah. But it's part of the gig. This is from Jesse Wilkerson. Your Rooster Cogburn from True Grit is so much different than the original. How did you build that character?
I started the way I start all the guys I play. I'd look inside myself, think of different aspects of myself that might link up with the character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which aspects of myself I might magnetize to, you know, that are maybe a little bolder in the character than of myself. And then certain aspects of myself that aren't in the character, kick those to the side, you know. And then I find when I'm in preparation for a role, I'm quite sponge-like, you know, in just looking at the world. And, I'll say, oh, look how that guy's sitting, you know. Look where how he's placed his hand, you know, those kinds of little details like that. And I'll jot that down on my script, you know, take a lot of notes and stuff. And start to work that way. And then one of the cool things about making movies is you're working with all of these masters in their art form. You know, like in Seventh Son, we worked with Jacqueline West in our costumes, you know. So early on in in making movies, you meet with a costume designer because it takes you quite early in the process because she's got to make all the clothes and it takes time, right? So you meet with this, you know, I met with Jackie. And she had spent all of this time researching the time period, you know, who my character might have been, you know. So to get her perspective gets my mind thinking, and you start to, you know, jam on the character in that respect. And then Dante Ferretti, who makes all the sets, says, this is where your character lives. And you go, oh, God, I didn't think about that. And look how he dresses the set. And that starts to inform your character. And then the director, of course, in this case, Sergei Bordov, this Russian guy who I just really enjoyed working with, he has a bunch of ideas. And so I bring my ideas to him. And I believe in really empowering the director to have power over me, you know, because I know what I'm thinking. But ultimately, hopefully, and it's not always the case, and in this case, in this case of this movie, I don't know. Why did I bring this subject up?
No, it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. But I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, Sergei and all the different people involved. But to varying degrees in movies, the director's vision is respected.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So right. Right.
Sometimes, like I remember a movie I did called A Million Ways to Die. You know, Hal Ashby. You know who Hal Ashby is?
Yes.
You know, a master director, Harold Ahmad, Coming Home, Being There. You know. But his – I'm rambling, but hopefully I'll get back to
it. No, it's fine.
His process, being an editor, that's where he came from. He was he edited the Thomas Crown Affair, Norman Jewison's editor. He won the Academy Award for Thomas Crown Affair, the original one with Steve McQueen. The script was just an outline, just kind of notes. And he believed intensely in improvisation. So he would cast, you know, his actors and then let the actors riff, you know, and just, it was a lot of improvisation, which drove the financiers crazy because this is not what you said you'd do, you know, but you got to look what's coming out of his oven, right? You got to look what the movies that he's made.
Yeah.
But these guys had no respect for Hal. They ended up firing him, didn't let him edit his movie, and they kind of cut it across the grain. And that was one of the most painful experiences in making a movie. Bo, my brother, did his first movie. I did his last movie.
Oh, wow.
But my point is, what I like to do is empower the director to have power over me to help me transcend my own visions of the character. So I'm not just playing myself, you know.
Right.
So I say, well, what do you think? You know, you think this is right? And normally I'll go with you know, incorporate his vision, because he's the guy who's going to cut up my painting and make a collage with it at the end. You know what I mean? And so he knows what he's going to need, you know?
Well, that's nice. I mean, that's empowering that guy. I mean, that's empowering a lot of trust in someone, because basically it, your face is up on the screen. So it's to trust someone to the extent where you go like, well, even if I don't fully understand what you're saying, like, I trust that you have a greater vision. Yeah. And I'm a piece of that.
Yeah. And I try to make that, that leap of trust before I engage in the project, you know, try to get that. But sometimes I must say, there are times when I'll go covert on the whole deal. And, you know, because I'm an artist too. I'm getting messages from where these sure. messages come from, and I'll give him his thing. But, you know, I'll ask him, can I just do one, you know, my way, just in case you might dig that, you know. But you've got to let it all go, because unless you're producing the thing, and the definition of producing, you know, changes on each assignment. But if you've got, you know, power in the final edit, you know, then you can incorporate some of your ideas in a more clear way. But often you just have to kind of give it up, and they're going to, you know, paste it all together.
So looping back around to Rooster Cogburn, was that
– Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Was that more your vision or the director's vision?
Oh, well,
or?
You got the Coen brothers, man. The masters. Come on. You know, give it up, man. You know, just do with them. So I bring all my stuff, you know, and they encourage – they want my stuff.
They do.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Because they're what so you got? Specific.
Yeah, but they want – they, you know, they – I remember when they first came to me with that idea. They said, we're thinking – you know, we want to do True Grit, and we'd love you to play the John Wayne part. I said, why do you want to do that? That's already been a great – you know, that's a classic movie. You know, what are you thinking? And they said, well, have you read the Charles Portis book? And I said, no. Then I read the book, and I totally understood, because it read like a, you know, Coen brother movie.
Right.
And I said, oh, yeah, thanks. Thanks for thinking of me, guys. You know, this is wonderful. And I, you know, got into it with the, you know, the same process that I was telling you before about how I approached the different parts. Yeah, that's basically it.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, have you ever gotten halfway through a movie and then went, oh, shit, I get the character now? Fucking! I've already filmed all this stuff.
Oh yeah, most often at the end. You know. But the ideal thing is when you discover, when you make that discovery on film, when it's rolling.
And you've had that.
That happens sometimes, and that's really in the late.
Can you think of an example?
God, you know, it happens kind of all through them, you know. It's
sure.
not, you know, just different time. You go, oh, yeah. And they capture it. That's just great.
And then from then on.
And then it's not a recreation of that you figured out in your hotel room preparing for the role, but it's right there, you know.
And then are you able to let it go at the end of the process? Like if you go, oh, shit, I just figured out this guy and now we're done and, oh, well, I guess, you know, it'll work out. It'll work out all fine.
Yeah, you got to let go finally at the end of all that stuff.
Yeah.
I remember a shot that kind of relates to what we were just talking about in the movie Fearless. Did you ever see that movie? Peter Weir was a wonderful director to work with in so many ways. I remember him saying to me, you know, talking about being inclusive and encouraging your thoughts, you know. He did that all the time, but he said, now, Jeff, we're going to be flying this plane together. I'm going to need you, you know, all your stuff, man, you know. And you know, when you get that kind of encouragement from the director, you know, you rise to it. Hal was very much that way, same way too. You know, I'll keep it tighter to what I was saying about Peter. I remember I was playing this architect who was in this terrible plane crash, and you know, architects are very, you know, straight lines and so forth. And I had this flash. Often, you know, I like to create in, you know, different mediums. You know, I'll play guitar, take photography, you know, ceramics. I love to draw and these different things. And I remember early in my career, I used to be kind of upset with myself because I'd be in my room there studying for my lines, you know, in the part. And then I'll say, oh, that would make an interesting song. Yeah. And I'll grab my guitar and I'll find, you know, a half hour later, I'm saying, what are you doing? You've got to see it tomorrow. You know. But then I've come to realize that when you start to shake up your creativity, all of it starts to bubble. So when we're doing Fearless, I find myself with an impulse to go out and buy all this art supplies and paper my room with these large sheets of paper and go at it with water and ink, you know, like as if I was in character, doing like an improvisation with myself, mm-hmm. in character of this guy who was an architect who was used to very kind of anal, you know, drawing lines, yeah. there, and just to kind of let go free. So I just went to town, man. And then the next morning, we had breakfast with Peter. And I went down. I said, look what happened last night. And he goes, oh, man, these are great. These are in the movie, you know. And so he put those in the movie. But that was not the story I wanted to tell. The story I wanted to tell was at the end of Fearless. Do you remember when I eat that strawberry?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big shot of me kind of, you know, all emotion and all kind of shit's breaking loose. Do you kind of recall that?
Yes,
slightly?
Yeah. I saw the movie in the theater.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. So it's the kind of the – and they have this great Gorecki, I think. You know, this – the music. It's the most beautiful score I think I've ever heard in a film. It just opens, never resolving, open. And the camera's, you know, slowly pulling down into a big close-up, or it might have been the other way. I can't remember. You know, start on a close-up and pull out. And Peter says to me, I'm going to torture you today. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, we're going to do this so many times, more times than I need to do it, more times than you can imagine. You got to trust me. And all those things he said were true. He just went on and on. He wanted to get past any kind of preconceived idea, his preconceived idea and my preconceived idea. He just wanted to, you know, just work it like that. And it was a wild choice for directors. And some directors, you know, do that. Michael Cimino is another guy. You know, I worked with him on his first movie, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot.
Right.
Where Clint Eastwood was producing it. And Clint likes to do, you know, just one or two takes, maybe three, you know. And I was the guy in that movie. I'd go up to Mike and I'd say, God, I got an idea. Can I do one more? He said, well, I have to go to the boss. He'd go to the Clint, and Clint would say, oh, yeah, give the kid a shot. But then a couple of years later, after Michael won the Academy Award for Deer Hunter, you know, he was the Hollywood's darling.
Right.
And they said, oh, yeah, make whatever you want. What would you like to make, Mr. Cimino? He says, well, I have this epic Western, you know, to make, Heaven's Gate. And he would do 60 takes.
Jesus. You know,
it was a completely different vibe. It was like, we're all costumed up. We'll shoot. But if we don't get it, we'll come back the next day. There was no sense of this is when it counts. And he was looking for that, you know, that thing they call the happy accident. You know, just that thing that just happens, you know.
Right.
And that was an interesting way of working. Very, you know, exhausting on some level, but something, some magic, you know, is captured. I think that movie really got a raw deal when it came out. You know, the critics, there's, you know, one critic just because Mike didn't want anybody to visit the set, so he created this kind of animosity, you know, from the suits and also all the critics, you know, because he wanted to just, you know, be us in the thing doing it. He didn't want to have to explain himself or any of that. And they went and got him, man, the reviews of that thing. You know, I remember one review said, if they shaved Cimino's head, they would find 3 sixes. You know, just attacked him on a spiritual.
Maybe,
you know,
a little, you know, extreme.
You know, but, you know, people read that, and then they see the movie with that filter. You can't see the movie. But that movie is a classic. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing film.
So when you're doing you know, to do 60 takes of something where you just get so lost, you probably don't even know what the fuck you're doing anymore at that point. How much of it – I guess this is a broader question. You know, with acting and photography and music – how much is craft of it and how much is art? Like, where do the two meet, and is one more important than the other?
What's the difference between craft and art?
Well, how much do you think, like, what do you think the right balance, you know, like, how is it important to, because some people are very artistic. Maybe they're, you know, they're not as their craft isn't as strong, but you're drawn to it because you're like, oh, this is such a raw expression of this thing. Or someone is so technically proficient in something, maybe sometimes it overshadows like, oh, the art organic side. Yeah. So like, what do you think the right balance is?
What I kind of go for is as an audience and as a performer, that there is apparently no obligation to the audience. And, you know, apparently is a really good word because it's all making movies. It's illusion, you know.
Sure.
So it's, there's apparently no you, and you do have an obligation to the audience because that's what we're here for, to tell this story and to elicit emotions and stuff out of the audience. But it's not apparent. I like the feeling of the audience just being a fly on the wall, happens to see the thing. And that can be achieved. And maybe this is an answer to your question, you know, as for craft and art. You know, I think there's two kinds of magic. You know, there's magic like Penn and Teller, you know, kind of magic. You know, wonderful illusions. See, how did that happen? You know, and in movies, that would be, you know, makeup or special effects, you know, these kinds of things. And in that, what gives this apparently this seamless quality of it, wow, that seems so real, is how subtly it's done. You know, you don't want in makeup or directing or any aspects, you know, in costuming, any of those, you don't want it to pop. You know, you don't want it to say, oh, well, that was an interesting directorial choice. You know, oh, look how bold those clothes are, you know, or wow, that beard, look how long.
Right.
Because that kind of takes you out of the story a little bit, just like a blink, or, you know, oh, look how, oh, he's crying so well, or all that kind of stuff. It makes you jump out. So that part of the magic, the fineness of that and doing the subtlety, and that kind of magic and subtlety rarely gets noticed because it's done so well.
Right.
You know, you'll get performances that are just so subtle and so real and very different from who the actual the person who's portraying it is, but they're doing it so finely that it's just, you know, it's miraculous. It's wonderful, but it's manipulating its craft. Then there's another kind of magic that's like alchemy, you know, like really turning, you know, gold, what is it, wine into water into wine, you know,
like
lead into gold.
Like iron into gold.
It's inviting the spirit into you to have its way with you, you know.
Can you make that happen or does it just happen?
Well, it's something that you can kind of practice. You know, you can, you know, prayer can do that. You know, you've got all these other creative people around you. There's a power in all that creativity. And if you acknowledge what you're up to and let's bring this in together, you know, you see, you know, rock groups, you know, holding hands, you know, before the press, you're just, you know, let's take advantage of this power that we have, you know. One of the things that I like to do, and I did on that Sleeping Tapes. Did you?
Yo, see, I've listened to Sleeping Tapes.
You know, Oming, you know, for instance.
Yes.
So, as a matter of fact, I think we're going to do. I feel some Oming coming on right now.
Do you want to make it happen?
Let's do it right now. So yeah, here's how it goes. And then, see, this is the reason I bring it up is that this is available to anyone, anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a bunch of people, you can Om, and there's something that happens when this goes down, and you know the Om, this symbol of the Om is that all the start with
and then people listening should do it along.
Even if they're on public
transportation or whatever, we'll
do this
together.
And then, and then you know it's supposed to be like the sound of the universe, all you know, the whole absolute sound. So now here's the kind of one of the challenges is that not to get all synced up. Because we, you know, all just being humans, we all have about the same capacity, you know, relatively,
sure,
you know, our lung capacity. So we want to kind of stagger that.
Okay.
So the Oming continues for quite a while.
You know okay.
I mean? And we have to commit for, you know, let's do it for, you know, a couple of minutes or something.
Sure.
This old time. And
Ohm time with Jeff Bridges.
And when you ohm, give it your all, you know, don't hold back or, you know, embarrass, just kind of thing, and let the, it can be different, you know, sounds may come out of you. Again, this is opening up to this spirit that wants to kind of come through you. You
sure.
Know, you don't have to be, you know, don't be worried about, you know, doing it right or anything like that, but.
But you are going to grade me afterwards, but, right?
Of course.
Okay, good.
Of course.
Okay.
But tap into your power that's available to you. Now, we're going to start with this lady here. What's your name?
Let's Ashley.
Ashley, because I think it's going to be good and cool. So it's going to go Ashley, Kyle, Katie,
and Chris,
me, and then my nephew, Dylan, over here. Okay? And then try to do it like about in the middle of the O sound.
Mm-hmm.
The next guy kicks in. And
okay.
Then, and then wait till that guy, and then you can kick you. So about when we get to Chris, you're going to be running out of breath. And then you just inhale again and kick it in again and dig the sound. And then it'll just go like that. We can get like a circle going. Okay, you ready?
I've never been more ready for anything.
Okay, here we
okay.
go. Katie,
on, Ash.
Yeah. Ashley.
Make it happen, Ash.
Ashley, here we go, Ash. Okay, I'm going to stop. I'm going to make a direction. We got to get closer. Come here.
Okay.
This is the best thing I've done all year.
Huh?
This is the fucking best thing.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
We got to get this thing close. But I think we even need to get closer.
Okay.
Like,
all right.
We got to get like,
all right.
Back, you know, back, all right. Back here.
Move back
yeah.
here.
Okay, now. Yeah. And get some, and let's get some volume cooking, okay?
All right.
Okay, let me see. Okay.
Microphones okay. move. We are all
crowded. Right,
really
right. Yeah.
We are okay. violating each other's personal
and
space.
And this is so wild. Thinking of your direction was so cool that we know not only are we doing this.
Yeah. People should join in.
All those people, man, we're connected in this
yeah.
way. Yeah.
Yeah, each person can
Katie's
be
Katie's making some adjustments. That's cool.
Each person listening will be the seventh person.
The seventh son.
Oh.
up a remix. Why don't we get together every...
Did you get off a little bit?
That was fucking
great. Did you get off a little bit?
My molecules were vibrating.
And where did that mind go? It's an interesting place.
It was naturally finding harmony with everyone.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't thinking about anything else.
Highly fascinating. And that's available to us, you know.
You have to come over every morning. We have to meet. And do
and just think if we did it like maybe a 5 minutes more or something. You see, then you get into like a little, you know, different spot. You know,
I love
it. You see how challenging it was to as far as the breath thing. You know, we all kind of link up, so to keep it staggered like that and how that works. It's something I'm still working on.
So it's your new podcast is going to be Coming Home with Jeff Bridges.
Home on the Range.
Home on the Range. It's just 10 minutes of ohms every morning.
Yeah.
10 minutes of different ohms. It'd be interesting to see how people react to that if they played along and they're like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Or like really kind of went, oh, wow, that was really – because, you know, part of what I start – part of what I think is when you're talking about like people holding hands, people trying to, you know, just like cleanse their mind before they go into something – you're basically, I think, trying to just get your brain out of the way.
Get out of
the
way.
So that you don't try to control everything.
Get out of the way. That's the deal. That's one of the things that I aspire to in any of my creative endeavors is to, you know, get that thing out of the way and let the thing come through.
Because your brain will try to control everything.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times from people who have a tough time quitting smoking, they go, I don't know if I could ever quit smoking. And I say – and I did in my 20s. I smoked in my 20s. And I say, well – I think a lot of it has to do with not – I mean, obviously there's the nicotine addiction. But when you think about what you're doing, it's focused breathing. Like you're focusing your breathing.
That's right.
It forces you to focus your breathing. So if you – you know, while you're trying to quit smoking, take time to focus your breathing, maybe do the ohms or maybe just breathe or maybe just – you know, that it just kind of gets all that other shit out of the way and just simplifies your moment.
That's it.
I guess.
That's it, man. Yeah.
Oh, that was so much fun.
Good, man. Thank you for allowing that.
No, please. I'm honored to have ohmed with you. I'll just throw a couple more questions at you, and then we'll let you go back to your press junket day. This is from Juliet Van – I'm going to say Scoik, S-C-O-Y-K. What talent have you portrayed on screen that you would like to have had time to master?
Playing the piano.
Oh, yeah. Fabulous. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fabulous
Baker Boys. And don't you hate it when you ask your mind for something and it just flips you the finger? You know, I'm trying to think. Dave Grusin, that's the guy who played all my parts. And we did, a good job of doing the craft magic that we were talking about, and how we created that illusion of me playing the piano.
Yeah.
Was that Dave... Grusin played all those parts and pre-recorded them before we did the show. And then when he was doing that, I asked the director, Steve Clovis, who I think he was like maybe 22 or something when he wrote that, 25 when he directed it. You know, can you imagine? And it's such a fine, mature piece of work. Anyway, I asked Steve, I said, can we get some video cameras on Dave Grusin? He had one on the top so I could just see where his hands were generally, and then one back to see his body movements. And we recorded that. And then I asked Steve if he could tell me what shots he was going to do were going from my face to my hands or from my hands to my face. And I say, tell me what bars of music you're going to do those. If we can establish that, then I'll practice those bars because I play piano a little bit, but certainly not like Dave Grusin, you know.
Yeah.
And I will learn those parts. And then when we shot the scene, we deadened my piano. I had what they call an earwig, a little you know, thing in my ear so I could hear Dave's playback.
Yeah.
And then I – just like doing a, you know, a voiceover, you know, the singing, like, you know, the who are the guys that got busted for it, you know.
Milli Vanilli?
Yeah, Milli Vanilli.
Yeah. Kind of thing. Why was that in the front of my brain?
That's right. That's very good. And so I would be playing the actual keys that Dave was playing, but what you heard was Dave. But so the illusion kind of worked cool. And then for the farther away shots, I could refer to the general videos, you know, the hands and – But during that movie, I got really turned on to Bill Evans. You know, you hip to Bill Evans.
Yeah.
You know, Kind of Blue. I don't think we got any better jazz album than that. That Miles Davis album, you know, and Bill Evans is all over that. And Steve Clovis, who was a jazz buff, is a jazz buff, said that Bill Evans was really your character's hero. And, he, you know, all the songs that and the style in which Dave Grusin played is all in that kind of Bill Evans voicings and that. So I would love to play piano better than I do.
Ah, so that kind of makes sense to me. So that I think defined the idea of craft and art. They can teach you the craft of how to where your hands go on the keys, but the art is actually the expression of like a master craft of like you master the. There's sort of a line speed beauty. I had a trainer. I've had the same workout trainer for a long time. We used to box, and he would always say line speed beauty. Learn the line, figure out what the movements are, then you can do it fast, and then you're free to, you know.
Oh, that's
beauty,
beautiful.
Line,
that's
speed,
but,
beauty.
Yeah. Oh, that's very line speed.
Line
beauty.
Speed
what
beauty.
Was the line thing? Learn the lines.
It's just like learn the technical parts. This is This is how you throw your body to throw your arm. Uh-huh. Speed is like okay.
How
now
fast
you know it.
You
now you know it. Now you can do it fast.
Yeah,
and then beauty is just letting it go and letting it be organic.
Man. That's very well put. Yeah.
Last question, and I am positive this is a question you've been asked a million times, but not on this podcast. So buckle up. This is from at CPL Fluffy. What was it about that rug that tied the room together so well?
You know it's Fluffy, is it?
Yeah, CPL Fluffy.
What's coming to mind, Fluffy, is I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, Fluff. But it sure did.
Maybe that's all the information you need.
It's a mystery, you know.
That's between you and not CPL Fluffy. Let's see if there's a better question to end on.
I've got something we can end on.
What do you want to end on?
Well, did you see this my Super Bowl commercial?
Yeah, for the tapes. Yeah,
there were sleep tapes. And I had a wonderful time making those sleep tapes, working with the Squarespace folks, you know, it was an advertisement for them, and their basic thought was to put out the message that no idea is too wild or crazy not to make a beautiful website out of it.
Yes.
Kind of specialize in that. That was their idea. And then they got these guys, Wieden Kennedy, this advertising company to be involved, and they came up with all these absurd ideas and approached me to say, would you be interested in doing one of these things? And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, yeah, but we want you to run with it. You know, do it however you want to do it. So I said, oh, shit, this is wonderful. I'll get my buddy Kephas Chauncea, who worked with T-Bone Burnett in creating that score for True Detective. Did you see that? You know, that ambient is so beautiful.
Fantastic.
And we worked on an album with T-Bone that T-Bone produced of mine a few years ago. So I think I could get that guy. And then I'll get my old buddy, Lou Beach, who is an incredible collage artist. He designed the cover of that album.
Mm-hmm.
And also he's a great writer. And so he wrote the four very short stories. He's a master at just a paragraph that is kind of like a whole world in it, one paragraph. And so I said, I'll get my playmates and we'll just jam and have fun. So we did that. And I got all my new friends at Squarespace and Wieden Kennedy. And we just cooked, man, for, you know, a couple. I was hired for 2 days, but I know, you know, come on, guys, we can't do this in 2 days. So it was just spread out over I don't know how much time. But the clincher and the most important thing about the whole deal, which came from Squarespace and Wieden Kennedy, was that all the sales from the downloads and from the albums and the box sets and all these things that are available, all of those proceeds will go to Share Our Strengths, No Kid Hungry.
Yeah, I saw that on the website.
Which is all about ending childhood hunger and bringing attention to this enormous problem that we have in America. I just read this report, and it was weird. It's not a liberal or a conservative report. I think I saw it on Fox. Was reporting this. That the Southern Education Foundation did this consensus of kids going to our public schools, and that 51%, the majority of kids going to our public schools, are from low-income families. These are all kids who qualify for free school breakfast. Mm-hmm. And only half of those kids are getting them. And the reason they're not getting them is because the free breakfast that they is available to them are available if they come a half hour early and eat in the cafeteria before school starts. And so a lot of these kids, half of them can't get to school that half hour early to eat in the cafeteria, or they don't want to have that stigma of being, I'm the poor kid who's got to go and
right,
eat.
Of thing. Course.
So they just don't go. So we've got so many kids showing up to school too hungry to learn. I mean, you know, you need a certain amount of calories to get your brain of cooking, course. You know. So this whole project of the sleeping tapes is all about bringing attention to that and raising money for this, you know, this wonderful organization, Share Our Strength, that's doing something about it. And what they're doing is working with school districts and governors and mayors and just citizens to move breakfast from the cafeteria a half hour before school to breakfast after the bell, after school starts. So all these kids are in the room together and they're all guaranteed to have a breakfast. It's available to them. They don't have to
eat. Is it a bureaucratic issue? Like someone has to vote? Like,
no. And here's the deal. This is what's so cool. It's not a matter of the feds creating a new law. There is this is already in place. The federal government gives over $1 billion to this concept. Mm-hmm. And a lot of states are implementing it, both, you know, again, conservative and liberal. We, the band, you know, the Biders, we've been touring around the country. We just worked with Governor Sandoval in Nevada, who is a Republican, and he's, you know, supporting this issue, making his state a no kid hungry state. We've got Governor Bullock up in Montana, you know, a state where I love. He's a Democrat. He's, you know, working on it in his state. And but a lot of governors aren't aware of this problem and that this federal money is available to them. But they need these programs in place. If they're not in place, you got the standard, you know, cafeteria deal going on.
That's awesome because the tapes are amazing. So the fact to know that you did those tapes, which by themselves are great, that you did that so that kids can eat, so that they can learn.
Yeah.
That's the best. You're the best person I've ever met, Jeff Bridges. We own today. You're feeding kids. Come on, man. And Seventh Son opens tomorrow. Well, actually, it's already out. Yeah, this will go up in a couple of days. Seventh Son is already out. People should go see it and continue to follow your photography, your music, the live album from the Abiders, and everything that you do. And you honestly, you can fucking come back whenever you want. You are welcome on this podcast. Right. If you said, Chris, I really feel like just for a period of time, I'll come on every Friday, own with some people, talk about some shit, shoot the shit, talk about photography. You could drop in. We could be in the middle of another podcast. And you go, hey, it's me, Jeff. And then I'll go, hey, sit down. Like you're 100%.
You're
welcome.
Thanks for the invite, Chris. I love that. We always have
It's always good
time.
To see you, man.
Always
Thank you
time.
So much. Right. And to everyone, I say, oh, enjoy your burrito. Perfect.
Cool one.
That was
good
great.
Session.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.